This is Doug Beebe, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 23rd of June, 2013. Doug Beebe, Part 2.
Ask about the flushing of the toilets on the ship.
Well, when we first arrived at Ali Bay on Kristadan, the first person up the gangplank was Sam.
What's his full name?
Milne Samuel. He lives in the Cayman Islands now. And he was one of the fids that was coming out from Halley Bay. And he dashed up the gangplank, dashed through the saloon, went to the toilet and flushed it. And I thought, that's a bit strange. And he came out with a smile on his face. He says, I've been waiting 2 years to hear that. Because he didn't know flush toilets. And so he'd missed flushing a toilet for 2 years. And that was his first action on the Kristadan. Yeah.
But he came back, didn't he, to do more work?
He did. He, my first year, he was in the UK, and then he came back again for my second year, so I got to know him then. But my first meeting with Sam was this incident on the Kristadan.
Did you do much survey work at all? Were you out with us?
Well, I was out with Rod surveying, and with Jeff Lovegrove. So I was humping telerometers up mountains and things so that they could get the readings and so on.
So you did get to climb some Antarctic mountains?
Yes.
Yeah. Any ones in particular?
Well, Station K was a first ascent. S was a first ascent. Both those had been attempted the year before by Di Wilde. And Di Wilde had said it would be good if we could get a survey point on top of those, rather than just looking at them from a distance. And Jeff Lovegrove said, do you think you can teach me enough ice climbing to get us up these mountains? So I did, and we got up them. There was a third one, which I can't remember now, but Jeff has got the details of that.
Was this tough work, or was it fairly straightforward?
K and S, the Sphinx, were serious climbing. Yeah, they weren't difficult climbing, but it was a matter of picking a route. Mm. And K was reasonably straightforward. It was a bit of ice climbing. You needed crampons on to get up. And I think Di Wilde wasn't familiar with crampons the year before. And this is what, a steep ice slope had stopped them. But Jeff and I... Jeff's very good. I taught him to use an ice axe and crampons, and we tattled those too, and enjoyed ourselves.
Did it beat Cumberland?
Yes.
Was there an extra thrill about it?
I think there always is. If you're doing something that you know has never been done before, then there's a sense of achievement there. There are still places in the world where mountains have still to be climbed. Some of them are, quite inaccessible. But well, not today. They're not, because you can fly in and out. But no, it was nice to say, I've got a first ascent.
Tick.
Yeah, and they weren't. They were detached mountains in their own right. It wasn't a part of the ridge that you just got up and just went from one to the other. Because the ice on the other side was much higher. These were actual standing free peaks, as it were. Not particularly big or daunting, nothing like the Matterhorn or anything like that, but nevertheless they were there, and it was good to do them. Rod, I remember when we did the Sphinx, was not impressed, because when we came down, he said, if you'd have fallen off there, who would have been picking up the pieces? We would. And I said, yeah, but we didn't fall.
You obviously got on very well with Porter, the first mechanic you worked with.
Yeah.
But then was he replaced by Peter Blakely?
Yeah.
How did you get on with the new man?
Great. Smashing guy.
Tell me more.
Oh, he came in. He'd been down with Paul Whiteman, who was the bass leader, before they knew each other. And we were friends from the moment we met, and he's a smashing guy. He lives in Leyburn at the moment. He's recovering from a stroke at the moment, but he's a smashing. We've been friends ever since.
There were at times nearly 30 people at Halley, weren't they?
32 the first year and 28 the second year, yeah.
Did they all get on with each other all the time, or were there odd men out?
The first year, I'd been on base, probably 6 months, maybe a bit more, when somebody pointed out to me that two people never sat on the same table at Smoker Hall, lunchtime or mealtimes. I hadn't noticed. And it was two people that just agreed to avoid each other. The second year, I think, was a much more cohesive group. And we all got on great. And like I say, Peter Blakely and I have been friends ever since. We've been on family holidays together since then.
So in that first year, it was understood by the group, the larger group, that these two chaps were to be left alone separately. There's no attempt to forge a friendship between them. It was just accepted, was it?
As far as I know, yeah. Like I say, it had happened before I'd got on base.
Right, so they agreed to differ.
They must have done.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I wasn't perceptive enough or what, but I just... It had never occurred to me, and I'd never noticed, that these two never sat on the same table.
Right.
It just hadn't registered in my brain at all.
Were there any other funny moments that you remember?
What, on base?
Yeah.
Oh, all sorts of things. First year, the washroom, Gash Day, the Black Hand Gang, that was Alf Amphlett, Shreddy Porter, myself and Robbie Reed were our Gash Day. You don't understand what Gash is.
Yeah.
I'm not talking foreign language. Then we were cleaning the washroom. Brian Porter and I cleaning the washroom, and Robbie came in and he said, "I'm going to have a shower." Now the shower system was a bit Heath Robinson. So we said, "Aye, okay, carry on." And we were cleaning the washroom up and doing, and there was a bath. And the system was that you filled a bowl with hot water and you put it in the bath. And then you filled a 5-gallon oil drum with hot water. And it had two hooks on it and there was a bar in the ceiling. And you hooked that over and you stuck a watering can rose on the tap. And you stood underneath it and turned the tap on and off. So Robbie gets busy arranging his shower and he put the 5-gallon drum up with hot water, and then said, "Oh, I forgot my clean clothes and my towel and my washing gear." So off he went up to the bunk room, and Freddie Porter said, right. So we lifted it down, poured the hot water back in the hot water tank, filled it with cold water, and hung it up again. And we carried on cleaning, and Robbie came back, and he went into the bathroom, and he stripped off, and Freddie says, "Now's the time to go." So we disappeared, and you could hear the screams and the battle all over the base when he turned the water on, because he stood in a bowl of hot water pouring ice cold water over it himself. Yeah, so that was one of the
any catering stories that you remember?
Oh yeah, Harry with his mashed potatoes.
Harry Rogers,
yeah. We were on our Gash Day, and he was dishing up the mashed potatoes, and of course he got a big pan of mashed potatoes. Scoops it out with his metal ladle spoon, you know, and I'm holding the plate, and he went like that, and instead of just flicking the mash off onto the plate, he hit the plate, and the plate went poom, and so his mashed potatoes were able to break a plate. And it happened twice, I think, that. And then one day, when we were on Gash again, the normal thing was you had soup and a main course at lunchtime, and then main course and a sweet in the evening. And we're there ready to dish up, and said, "What's the soup, Harry?" "Ah, I haven't made any." And it was, I think it was stew, mashed potatoes and peas. So he's hurriedly putting the peas through the liquidiser. We're taking out pea soup. Yeah, but these things happen. We took a turn on helping the cooks, and I decided one day that I would make butterfly buns, which was you know, I thought, I don't have to do that. So I made these butterfly cakes, got them made, and scooped the tops out and cut the tops in half and made the buttercream to go in. The only thing was I got the wrong sugar. And so the sugar was gritty. So they got christened Roadmaker's Buns with Gravel Cream. But, yeah.
When it came time for you to leave at the end of your second year, were you had you had enough, or were you sorry to leave?
No, I think I'd had enough, to be honest. I suppose you could say, yeah, you could have done it again, but I'd got a girlfriend who'd waited 2 years for me and wanted to get married. So, I wanted to get married. So.
You got married in Port Stanley?
Yes.
So she flew out, did she?
Yes.
Is this the same lady you're with here this weekend?
Yes.
And her name is?
Anne.
Okay.
And we've been together since 1967. Yeah.
So why were you keen to get married in Stanley? Had you got something lined up?
Yeah, the original plan was we were going to go to the Mexico Olympics. This was the this was the plan. So my mother and Anne flew out to Montevideo and got the Darwin down to Port Stanley, and we got married in Christchurch Cathedral on Anne's birthday.
How was that?
Fabulous. The lads that were in Port Stanley had an archway of ice axes outside the church when we came out. It was Ted Clapp stood in for Anne's father and gave her away. It was a really magical day. Yeah.
Did the local people come and yes. support the wedding as well?
Yeah, they did, everybody. Because I was living in Diggs with Nellie and Richie Anderson up on Philomill Hill, and I was working in the garage at that. Well, no, I'd just finished by the time we got married, but when they came out, I'd been working in the garage for Richard Hills. Because Ted Clapp got me a job there as a mechanic.
In Stanley?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
How had you kept that relationship going for 2 years?
Telegrams, flowers. Anne had been to see him and stay with my mother. It just lasted. All from picking her up at a bus stop. Yeah, that was the way we met. I'd already signed on with Bass, and my birthday's in July. Well, we were having a party at my mother's house, and I'd got a girl from Keswick who was working in Manchester, who I invited to this party, and I just said, you know, we're having this party, some of the lads from the Mountain Club are coming up, and various people, but we're short of females, we haven't got many girls coming. Do you know anybody that, you know, enjoy a night? And she said, well, there's this girl who has a flat near me, and they work together in different departments in Lewis's in Manchester. And she said, the only thing is she works. She's a cashier at a bingo hall, because she had two jobs. So she said, we can run out and pick her up. So we ran out to this bingo hall, and she'd finished. She'd gathered all the money in, done the accounts and so on. And she said, oh, she must be on her way back to the flat, so we'll run round. And as we came away from the bingo hall, she was still at the bus stop waiting for the bus. So we pulled up and said, you know, Lynn said to her, look, this party's on, do you want to come? And Anne said, oh, yeah, okay, then, you know. And that's how we met.
So the lack of punctuality of Manchester Corporation buses was quite useful.
Yeah, it must have been, yeah. Yeah.
But you stayed in the Falklands for a while. You got a job. I presume New Ireland is a Falkland island, is it?
It's an island on the far west.
manager, whatever that means.
Yeah. Well, the owner, Jack Davis, Cracker, was coming to the UK, as they say, coming home for 6 months. And he wanted a standing manager for the island on a 6 month contract.
What were you managing?
Basically a sheep farm.
Yeah.
He'd got 3,500 sheep on the book. He'd got nearer 4,500 on the islands itself, because it was a group of islands. There was New Ireland, Knob Island, Coffin Island, and Ship Harbour Island, things like that. And he owned all this. He'd got a 17-year-old son who he couldn't trust with the job. He'd got a son-in-law who I don't think he trusted. He'd got a his wife's father, who was 80, well, in his 80s anyway, and a navvy called Davy on the island, and Tom Smith, his son-in-law, and Helen had got two children. That was the total inhabitants of the island settlement.
And how was that? Because you were not a qualified shepherd, were you?
No, wasn't. Didn't know very much about sheep at all. I mean, I'd been into Derbyshire when in my youth hostling days, digging sheep out of snowdrifts and so on for farmers, but no, I had to rely on Tom Smith, who turned out to be a great guy, and Raymond and Davy to actually do. But I learnt a lot about the sheep there, and it, you know, it was a very enjoyable 6 month honeymoon. Yeah.
You never made it to the Mexico Olympics.
No, we didn't. No. Nature took its course. Anne got pregnant, and we were advised to by the doctor, because she's not. She's only small, as you've probably seen. She's still vertically challenged, as they call it, or something like that. Anyway, the doc said if it's a big baby, you could have birthing complications. So I suggest you get to civilization somewhere rather than risk. Having problems, so we came back to the UK.
Did you stay in education? Did you return to education?
I did, yes. When we got back, fortunately, my mother had a house in Denton that was she'd converted into two flats, and the tenants of the flat upstairs had just left. So we were able to move into that until I got a job. And I got a job in Keighley in Yorkshire for starting in January through to the summer.
How do you regard, final question, how do you regard those 2 years in the Antarctic as in your lifespan as a whole?
Oh, I think enjoyable, extending. It certainly made me think about life and what I was doing. Made me careful. I think I was still inclined to take risks in certain directions at times, which I've, you know, I've done all my life. But it's, you know, I enjoyed it. And I made some lifelong friends, which has seen me through life up to now. And it's been enjoyable, yeah.
And so is this last hour and a quarter. Thank you very much indeed.
You're very welcome.